Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 158 of Game Master's Journey. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. On this show, we discuss the craft and art of game mastering. I've been running RPGs for over 25 years now, and I produce this show in the hopes that you can benefit from my experience, my triumphs, and my screw-ups. I've got a great show for you today. I'm going to return to my in-depth discussion of the Dungeon Master's Guide, and today we're going to talk about creating settlements for your campaign. But before I get to that, I have an exciting announcement to make. I think it's an exciting announcement. I am going to start producing monthly bonus episodes for Game Master's Journey. So this show is going to keep coming out every week like it almost always does. But in addition to that, I'm going to at least once a month, produce an extra bonus episode. So unless this is your first episode of Game Master's Journey, you know that I have a Patreon, and the patrons are what make this show possible and what keep this show going. And one of the rewards, one of the perks that I have been doing for the patrons is a special monthly podcast called The Patroncast. And I've been producing that every month for the patrons for almost 2 years now. Well, after much thought and deliberation, I have decided to retire the Patroncast, at least for now. I may occasionally do episodes of the Patroncast when I have announcements about Game Master's Journey or Star Walker Studios that I want to share with the patrons. But instead of doing the Patroncast every month, what I'm going to do going forward is once a month, I'm going to do an extra episode of Game Master's Journey. I spoke with the patrons about this, and the patrons that I heard from were all either neutral or in favor of this, and so this is what we're going to do. Now, I would like to do something special with these bonus episodes. I want them to be a little different than the regular episode, and I think that will probably vary from month to month what exactly I do, and I've gotten some ideas from the patrons on what to do with these episodes. So this month for June 2017, I think what I'm going to do is have kind of a feedback episode. I get a lot of feedback for the show. I get a lot of questions. I get a lot of ideas for show topics. And I've had a pile of this stuff building up of topics that either I just haven't gotten to them, or questions I haven't gotten to, or topics that really aren't enough for a full episode. So instead of never getting to them or waiting until I feel like I have enough to do a full episode on it, I thought it'd be fun to go through some of these topics and just bang a bunch out in a special bonus episode. So be looking for that sometime later this month. Also, speaking of the patrons, whom I love and appreciate, and speaking of the Star Walker Studios Patreon, I wanted to let you know that we are getting really close to the next milestone on the Patreon. And if you're unfamiliar with Patreon, it's basically very similar to Kickstarter, and just how on Kickstarter you have stretch goals, on Patreon you have milestones. So all the patrons on Patreon agree to donate a certain amount every month, and they choose whatever that amount is. And at different levels, I have different rewards. And then also, when the Patreon as a whole gets to certain points, we have milestones. So we're really close to the next milestone, like I think two or three $5 patrons away from the next milestone. And that next milestone is I do Game Master's Journey live streams. So in addition to the podcast I do every week, in addition to the extra episode I'm going to do every month, I will do a monthly live stream that will be on YouTube, and you can come and watch it live and participate in the chat channel. And I'll talk about the same kind of stuff we talk about on Game Master's Journey, but it will be video, it will be live, and you can interact with me, you can ask questions, give comments on whatever the topic is, and I may occasionally pull people into the live stream to participate. And when I do that, any patrons that are in the audience will get first dibs on coming on the show with me. So I'm really excited to do this, and I'm really excited to do it, and I hope that we hit this milestone soon. So if you haven't checked out the Patreon, please check it out. If you've been kind of going back and forth on becoming a patron, this would be a great time to do it, because we get a few more patrons and we hit that milestone and I can start doing the live streams, which I think will be a lot of fun. And one thing that I've heard from patrons and other listeners of the show is they'd like to have more interaction with me and with each other on the show, and start building more of a community around Game Master's Journey. And I would like that too. And I think doing these live streams would be a great way to do that. And when we hit this milestone and I start doing this, it's going to start out being once a month. But honestly, I'd like to do them more often. So if it's successful and people participate, I'd love to do them even more often than once a month. Maybe even as often as once a week. That would be cool. I'd also like to welcome and give a shout out to two new patrons of Starwalker Studios, Ben Stapleton and Joshua Davis. Thank you both for becoming patrons. I really appreciate it. So you can head on over to starwalkerstudios.com, and there you can find a link to my Patreon page and you can check it out. And once again, thank you to all the patrons. I really appreciate your support. Returning to our discussion of the Dungeon Master's Guide today, we are still in Part 1, Master of Worlds, Chapter 1, A World of Your Own. Last time we talked about mapping your campaign, and today we're going to talk about settlements. The places where people live. Bustling cities, prosperous towns, and tiny villages nestled among miles of farmland help define the nature of civilization in your world. A single settlement, a home base for your adventurers, is a great place to start a campaign and begin your world building. Consider the following questions as you create any settlement in your world. First, what purpose does it serve in your game? How big is it? Who lives there? What does it look, smell, and sound like? Who governs it? Who else holds power? Is it part of a larger state? What are its defenses? Where do characters go to find the goods and services they need? What temples and other organizations feature prominently? What fantastic elements distinguish it from an ordinary town? Why should the characters care about the settlement? So this is basically a checklist, if you will, that you could go through anytime you create a settlement, whether that's a village or a town or a city. And throughout the rest of the section and what we're going to be talking about today, we go through each of these areas in more detail. So last time in our discussion of mapping, I discussed briefly the difference between the top-down approach and the bottom-up approach. And with either of those approaches, eventually you're going to get to a point where you're creating settlements. However, with the bottom-up approach, this will probably be one of the first things, if not the first thing, that you do in your world building, where in the top-down approach, you're probably going to do a lot of world building before you get down to developing a particular settlement. So the first thing we can think about when we're coming up with a settlement is, what's its purpose? Now, from a game perspective, a settlement exists primarily to facilitate the story and the fun of your campaign. But other than that, the settlement's purpose determines the amount of detail you put into it. Create only the features of a settlement that you know you'll need, along with notes on general features. Then allow the place to grow organically as the adventurers interact with more and more of it, keeping notes on new places you invent. So last time I talked a little bit about the concept of world builder's disease, and how one of the problems I see with the top-down approach is it can lead more readily to world builders disease than taking the bottom-up approach. And just in a nutshell, world builders disease is when you are spending way too much time world building, and from an RPG perspective, too much time world building instead of actually running games in your setting. You know, look at it this way. All the time that you do the preliminary world building, what you feel like you need to have in your pocket before you start running games, the more time you spend with that preliminary world building, the more time your players have to wait to play D&D, or the more time you have to wait to play D&D. So all of us are going to need some kind of or some degree of preliminary work done. Some DMs will want more than others, but we're all going to want some. But what you want to try to avoid is doing more than you need to. And that is a recurring theme we will see throughout the Dungeon Master's Guide, is really managing your time, because few of us have infinite time. Well, none of us really have infinite time, but most of us are operating on time constraints where we don't have as much time to work on our games as maybe we would like to have. So whatever time you do have before your next session to prepare, whether that's an hour or 4 hours or 8 hours, it behooves you to spend that time wisely and to first and foremost focus on things that you're going to need for that next session before you waste time on things that you're not going to need or not going to use. So we're taking this concept right into creating our settlement. You know, when we start thinking about how we're going to flesh out this settlement, we want to focus on what we're going to need or what we're most likely going to need. So if you're starting your adventure in a small town, and the player characters are going to meet at a tavern, then the tavern is something you're going to want to think about a little bit. What's the tavern look like? What are some of the people that will be in the tavern? You know, the person behind the bar, the person waiting on their table, perhaps a few other patrons that are there at the same time, things like that. You don't so much want to spend time working on a farmer's house on the outside of town that they're not likely to go to. So, you know, think about, for this session coming up, what am I most likely going to need? And of course, you're not always going to know. You know, maybe you think, okay, well, it's going to start out in the tavern, so I need the tavern. And then there's going to be some kind of call to adventure, some kind of hook that the player characters will encounter in the tavern, and that's going to lead them to my adventure location that is maybe an old castle outside of town. So you think, okay, I need the tavern and I need the castle and I need kind of the route that they're going to take from the tavern to the castle, at least as much as I'm going to describe that. And so that's what you focus on. But then maybe when you go to run the session, maybe the player characters decide to go shopping and they want to go to the general store. And now, you know, maybe you haven't thought about the general store at all. So that is where improvisation comes in. And, you know, no matter how much time you spend preparing, no matter how much you flesh out your world, you're always going to have to do improvisation at least at certain points, because the players will always find somewhere to go or something to do that you didn't anticipate. So, you know, improvisation is part of the game for Dungeon Masters, and it's a part of the game that we should embrace and work on and develop those skills. But it's also, you know, like any tool in your GM toolbox, there are times and places that are better to use it than others. You know, like the tool analogy, if you need to drive a nail, a hammer is the best thing to do. But if you need to screw in a screw, you know, a hammer isn't going to be the best thing to use. It might work in a pinch, but it's not going to be the best thing to use. So, you know, the same thing with having prepared material and having things that you improvise at the table. There are times and places for both, and there are situations that are more ideal for one or the other. So when it comes to planning a settlement, you know, I would recommend, as the DMG does here, focus on elements that you know you'll use first. And then if you have time, focus next on elements that you think are likely. For instance, the general store or the blacksmith or, you know, places like that, places that, you know, you're not absolutely sure the PCs are going to go there, but there's a good chance that they will, if not in this session, then in a future session. So those are things that you can work on once you have the things that you know you're going to need fleshed out. So next we have local color. A settlement might serve as a place where the characters stop to rest and buy supplies. A settlement of this sort needs no more than a brief description. So this isn't a place where you're planning to have the PCs spend a lot of time and kind of the home base of the PCs. This is just some place they're passing through. So a place like that, you don't even need as much development as you would do for a settlement where they're going to spend more time. Maybe just a short description. That's all you really need. And then you improvise the rest. Include the settlement's name, decide how big it is, add a dash of flavor. For instance, the smell of the local tanneries never lifts from this town. And let the adventurers get on with their business. So this reminds me of another point I wanted to make when I was talking about, you know, preparing what you think you need for the session. And I mentioned, well, maybe you didn't anticipate that the player characters would want to go shopping and they decide, hey, we want to go to the general store and buy some gear or some supplies or whatever. And you're not ready for that. And I said, well, that's an instance where you might need to improv. And that's definitely one way you could approach that. But another way you could approach it is just to hand wave it. You know, as a game master, we fulfill a lot of roles during the game. And one of those roles is similar to the director on a movie or a TV show. So to extend the metaphor, as a game master, you choose where the camera goes during a given game session, during a given adventure, during a given story. And oftentimes that choice on, you know, what is going to be on camera versus what's going to be off stage is based on what's interesting, right? Like oftentimes in TV shows or movies, we don't see characters going to the bathroom or eating dinner or whatever because it's not interesting. Now, if there's some interesting dialogue that occurs, then you might see that. But unless there is interesting dialogue or unless something interesting happens, the director is not going to waste the audience time with watching a character eat or go to the bathroom or some other mundane, boring, everyday thing. So we do the same thing as game masters. We decide what the camera is going to focus on or what we're going to spend game time on. So when the player characters or the players say, hey, we want to go shopping, as a game master, you decide, is this worth taking up valuable time at the table dealing with? And maybe you have an interesting NPC where the player characters are going to go shop or you have some plot hooks you want to drop or story seeds or possible quests or some information they might get from this NPC. So in that instance, you might say, yeah, you know, this is a scene I want to play out. We're going to have you, you know, go into the shop and barter with the NPC or whatever. And, you know, if there's a point to that, if there's a reason to do that, to spend time on that, then that's awesome. You know, and that's a great thing to do. However, there are going to be a lot of times where there is that, right? You don't have some important information they're going to get from the merchant or some story reason to really spend time at the table on the scene of the PC shopping. So in that case, you can do what we call hand wave it. This is something that happens in the game. It's something that happens in the continuity of the story, but it happens off stage. So in that case, you say to the players, okay, cool. You guys want to go shopping? Fine. You go to the store, buy what you need to buy. You know, maybe you have them tell you what they want and you tell them how much it costs, or you just say, hey, you know, what I often do is I'll say, hey, anything in the player's handbook, in the equipment that's under a certain gold piece value is available, and it just costs what's in the player's handbook, and you guys take care of that, spend the money. Like, I don't need to micromanage you buying stuff. So again, you might decide to hand wave it because it's not interesting. Nothing important to the story is going to happen there. And you don't want to spend valuable time at the table with shopping. But another reason you might hand wave it is because you weren't ready to go there. So maybe you're thinking, hey, I might have some interesting NPCs at the store, but I haven't come up with them yet. Or that might be a great place for the player characters to learn some rumors or maybe hear about some possible quests they can go on. But I'm not ready to do that yet. So you can, for this session, just hand wave it and say, okay, you guys go to the store, you buy what you need to buy, moving on. And then the next time they want to buy something or they want to come back and sell loot, now you're prepared. Now you have those NPCs ready. Now you have some dialogue or some information that you want to get across. And so now you say, okay, well, this time we're going to role play it. So, you know, that's another tool in your toolbox to remember is as a GM, you decide where the camera goes. You decide what happens on stage and what happens off stage. So a great way to approach the player characters doing something unexpected, if you don't want to improvise it, or if you don't think it's worth the time and energy to improvise it, is to just have that thing happen off stage. So that could be anything from, it could be a whole stay at a place. So maybe the player characters are traveling and they stop the night in a village and you don't really have anything interesting planned to happen in the village. It's just a stop on the way and you've got other things you want to get to this session. So you could just hand wave the whole stay at the village and say, okay, you know, you guys stay at this village, mark off X amount of gold for your room and your food that you know, you have while you're there. And unless, you know, someone wants to buy something else or do something specific, we're just going to move on to the next day on the road. And you can do that whenever you want as a GM with anything you want. So it could be a stay at a village. It could be a shopping trip. It could be maybe the player characters go to a temple to get potions or to get healing performed. And it's not something you want to spend time with. You can just hand wave it and say, okay, it costs you X amount of gold to get the healing and we're moving on. You know, or you can choose to go there. Maybe there's something you want to accomplish at that temple with an NPC or something like that. So I guess I kind of have two points here. One point is think about what you want to happen on stage and off stage from a perspective of what's worth your time at the table, right? Maybe you guys only have 3 or 4 hours to game this week. Do you want to spend an hour of that shopping? If you do, great. If the players do, great. But if not, hand wave it. You know, you use what you put the camera on, what you put the spotlight on to focus what's important that's going on right now. So maybe the shopkeeper is going to be an important NPC in the story, and so you want to focus on that. But the other point is you can also use the onstage, offstage thing to deal with unexpected places that the player characters go that you don't want to improvise. So going to the temple could be a great example. You know, maybe I haven't given a lot of thought to the temple yet, but it is something I'm planning to do more with in the future. So I don't necessarily want to improvise a temple right now because it is something I want to use in the future. And I don't want to improvise something that later isn't going to work with what I want to do with it. So maybe I just want to hand wave the temple and move on so that I don't shoot myself in the foot improvising. If, on the other hand, they're in a village that they're just passing through and I'm never going to use this temple again, and I don't care, maybe I want to improvise it. Maybe I don't. So really, the key is you get to decide, and there can be a lot of things that go into that decision, but never feel like you have to have everything happen on camera, right? You're not going to narrate the player characters going out in the woods to take a leak, right? Probably not. You're not going to narrate them cooking dinner every night during camp, or hopefully you're not, right? That'd get pretty boring. So, you know, that concept can extend to anything that the player characters do. You can even do this with combats. You know, I've used a technique, you know, called the travel montage, where the player characters are traveling a long distance and they may have combat encounters that they happen, but they're not interesting enough to spend a lot of time at the table with. I don't want to roll initiative and spend half an hour doing combat, but I do want to say, oh, you guys were ambushed by some goblins or something. So instead, together, me and the players will decide what happened from a narrative point of view, but we're not going to sit there and roll a bunch of dice. So you can even do this with combat. All right, so going back to the local color, we're talking about how if this is a settlement, they're just passing through. You don't need a lot of details, just a few things to make this place seem like a real place and seem unique. So the history of the inn, where the characters spend the night, the mannerisms of the shopkeeper they buy supplies from, you can add this level of detail if you want, but you don't have to. And again, I would say your guide as to whether to add that detail or not is doesn't matter. You know, if there's nothing interesting going to happen at the inn, then save that cool idea for an innkeeper that you came up with for a later inn where something interesting will happen. If the characters return to the same settlement, start adding these local features so that it begins to feel a little more like a home base, albeit a temporary one. Let the settlement develop as need arises. And again, this is a common theme in world building that's advised here in the DMG, and I completely agree with it. Create what you need as you need it. And whether we're talking about a settlement or an NPC, as the players return to that person or place again and again and again, you're going to flesh it out more and more each time. And over time, organically, it will become more realized. But that way, you're not front-loading too much and coming up with all this stuff for a settlement that they only visit once and never come back. If they come back to the settlement, then you can come up with more details. And if they come back a third time, you can come up with more, and so on and so on. All right, so now let's talk about a home base. A settlement gives the adventurers a place to live, train, and recuperate between adventures. An entire campaign can center on a particular town or city. Such a settlement is the launching pad from which the characters go out into the wider world. Designed well, a home base can hold a special place in the adventurers' hearts, particularly if they care about one or more NPCs who live there. To make a home base come alive, you'll need to invest some time fleshing out details, but the players can help you with that work. Ask them to tell you a bit about mentors, family members, and other important people in their characters' lives. Feel free to add to and modify what they give you, but you'll start with a solid foundation of the NPCs who are important to the characters. Let the players describe where and how the characters spend their time, a favorite tavern, library, or temple perhaps. Using these NPCs and locations as a starting point, flesh out the settlement's cast of characters. Detail its leadership, including law enforcement. Include characters who can provide information, such as sages, soothsayers, librarians, and observant vagabonds. Priests can provide spellcasting as well as information. Make note of merchants who might regularly interact with the adventurers and perhaps compete with one another for the party's business. Think about the people who run the adventurer's favorite tavern, and then add a handful of wild cards: a shady dealer, a mad prophet, a retired mercenary, a drunken rake, or anyone else who adds a dash of adventure and intrigue to your campaign. And again, notice here that we are focusing on things that are directly relevant to the player characters and what we anticipate they're going to be doing. Now, as a game master, unless you have magic powers that I lack, you can't predict the future. You can't always predict what your players are going to do, but you can make some assumptions, and some assumptions are fairly safe to make. So, you know, this home base is a place that we're going to put more time and thought into because hopefully we're going to spend some time here. Now, of course, the player characters could just leave and never come back, but hopefully we're going to spend some time here. So this suggestion of having player characters give you some ideas for NPCs that are important to their characters at the beginning of the game or at the beginning of the campaign is a great suggestion. Now, I will say that if there are any parameters that you are concerned about, you want to make sure the players know those before you ask for these characters. For instance, if in the settlement you've decided that there are no dwarves, tell the player characters or the players that before you ask them to come up with NPCs so that, you know, you don't have a player coming up with all these dwarven NPCs and you have to be like, oh, sorry, there's no dwarves here. And that's something I'm telling you from personal experience, because it seems like every time I've asked for this, there's always NPCs that players come up with that I feel like they don't really fit the settlement. So, you know, you really want to, as much as you can, give any guidelines that there might be as far as, you know, these certain types of people do or don't exist here, things like that. And, you know, again, we're focusing, as far as NPCs to populate the settlement with, we're focusing on NPCs we think the player characters are likely to interact with. So, you know, like it mentions here, some safe bets are the staff at the inn where they stay. The blacksmith, you know, they're going to need armor and weapons repaired. They might want new armor crafted, things like that. The, you know, any merchants that would sell any goods that they would want, rather, whether that's arrows or trail rations or whatever, you know. So you can kind of think about, you know, what are the most likely NPCs the player characters will interact with, and start there. And of course, they'll throw you curveballs. Some player will come up with something that they want to do that you never thought of, but that's where you improvise. All right, so, you know, we've got our home base, which is a settlement, and then nearby, we want one or more adventure sites. A village harboring a secret cult of devil worshippers, a town controlled by a guild of were-rats, a city conquered by a hobgoblin army. These settlements aren't merely rest stops, but locations where adventures unfold. In a settlement that doubles as an adventure location, detail the intended adventure areas, such as towers and warehouses. For an event-based adventure, note the NPCs who play a part in the adventure. This work is adventure preparation as much as it is world-building, and the cast of characters you develop for your adventure, including allies, patrons, enemies, and extras, can become recurring figures in your campaign. And something I like to say is that as a game master, no prep that you do is ever really wasted, even if you don't use it for the session you run, or at least in an ideal world, it's never wasted. So as game masters, you know, we should do our best to ensure that things that we prepare or come up with aren't wasted. So, you know, if I come up with this really interesting innkeeper and the player characters never go to the inn or never talk to the innkeeper, you know, I save that innkeeper and use him somewhere else. The players will never know because they never interacted with him. So I can use him in some other inn and some other place that they do interact with. I can just be like, okay, the next innkeeper that they actually interact with will be this innkeeper that I already came up with. So I think that this approach that they're presenting here is a great way to approach creating a campaign and creating a world, especially if you're fairly new at this. This is a great way to do it. And as they say, you're kind of building your world and you're building the campaign that you're going to run at the same time. They go hand in hand. So you start with the bottom-up approach to world building, you know, and just, I mean, just go through the Dungeon Master's Guide in order. It's like, this is like a step-by-step manual on creating a world and creating a campaign. You know, we start out with thinking about the setting as a whole. Am I going to run in Forgotten Realms? Am I going to run in Dark Sun? Am I going to come up with my own thing? We think about broad things about the setting. How much magic is there? How old is the world? How settled is it? How safe is it? Things like that. Start with those core concepts of the world. Kind of get a handle on that. What is this world like? Then we immediately go to the bottom-up approach to mapping. We say, okay, I've got this basic idea of what my world is like. That's all I need as far as big picture stuff right now. Now I'm drilling down to a single province scale map, which is going to have some kind of settlement, what we're talking about today, in the middle. And then this map is going to detail how far the player characters can venture in about a day of travel in every direction from this settlement. I'm going to fill this map with some interesting places that the player characters can go, some interesting adventures they can have. I'm going to focus on this settlement at the middle for their home base. I'm going to populate it with some interesting NPCs. Maybe there'll actually be some interesting adventure locations within the settlement itself or very nearby. And among those interesting NPCs, I'm going to have NPCs that will serve as hooks to get the player characters into some of these adventures that are nearby. And this is a great way to approach both developing a campaign and developing your world all at the same time. And what I like about this approach and why I'm using this approach myself is you don't need to sit there and do a bunch of work all by yourself for weeks or months or years or whatever and not be able to play the game or not be able to run the game. You can sit down, spend a very small amount of time, and then be up and running, running your game. And there's a couple nice things about that. First of all, world building, designing a campaign, all that stuff, and not actually running the game, you can get burnt out. And before you even start the adventure, you're sick of it. You're tired of world building. You're tired of doing it. You don't want to do it anymore. And you never ran any of it. That can happen. That's one thing you want to avoid. Another thing is once you actually hit the ground and you take off on your adventure, on your campaign, you now have all of the players at your table helping you, right? You know, like let's take this settlement we're talking about. Like we already talked about, you know, when you have the players make their characters say, hey, as part of making your character, you know, here's a little bit about where we're starting, this town that we're starting in, or village or whatever it is. I want you to come up with a few non-player characters who are important to your character. They could be the person who taught you how to be a wizard. They could be another thief that you know in the area that you trade information with. They could be a past lover that things ended badly with. Whatever, you know, interesting characters from your character's past and present. And most importantly, characters that you want to see come up during the story. And if you have four players and each of them comes up with two of those characters, right away, boom, you've got eight NPCs, or at least the beginning of eight NPCs that you can use in the coming adventures. And not only did they do some of the groundwork for you, but at least that one player that came up with that particular NPC is going to be kind of invested when you bring that NPC on the stage. You're going to be like, oh, hey, this is my lover that things ended badly with, or this is my rogue contact, or this is my wizard mentor. And they're instantly going to be a little more into what's going on because it's a way of putting spotlight on their character. And this is an NPC that they helped create, and players dig that kind of thing. It gives them connection to the world and to the story, and more so than they would have had without it. So not only can the players help you with NPCs in the settlement, but they can help you with all kinds of stuff as much as you want them to. So maybe they throw a curveball at you. Maybe they want to go to the temple when you haven't thought much about the temple beyond that they worship God X, Y, and Z there. Well, you can totally improvise that if you want, or you could hand wave it and just say, hey, we'll worry about what the temple's like some other time. Or you could ask for the players to help you. You know, so they go into the temple and you say, okay, this is a temple to the goddess of agriculture, Primordia. What do you think this temple looks like? What do you think the priest is dressed like? You know, you can ask for any details like that that you want from the players. And now instead of you having to come up with everything, you've got all the people at the table throwing out ideas. And together as a group, you can flesh out some things about this temple. And you've got a lot more ideas flowing coming from multiple people. So it's hard to do that when you're not actually running the game. But once you're running the game, the players can help you a lot with your world building, and they a lot of times enjoy doing it.
This is Matthew Colville, and you're listening to Game Master's Journey.
I want to take a minute to give a quick shout out to the patrons of Starwalker Studios. The support of the patrons makes this show possible. If you enjoy Game Master's Journey and you'd like to give a little back, becoming a patron is a great way to do so. It's because of the patrons that all the listeners of Game Master's Journey enjoy a bonus episode every month. I'd also like to give a huge shout out and thank you to my Tier 4 patron, Mr. Steve Strickland. Let's hear it for Steve.
Yeah.
Yes.
You're the best. you the man.
Thank you so much, Steve, and thank you to all the patrons. You can find out more about becoming a patron by clicking on the Patreon button at the top of the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. All right, so we've talked about, you know, creating a settlement and different types of settlements, and anything from just a place the player characters pass through, and we're not going to spend much time developing it at all, other than, you know, maybe a few interesting details that they notice, all the way to the other side of the spectrum, to a settlement that's going to serve as a home base where the players are going to spend a lot of time and return to again and again and again. So now, as we turn to actually creating these settlements and fleshing them out more, the first thing we can think about is, how big is this place? Is it a village? Is it a city? Is it something in between? So for this, in the DMG, we have a few basic sizes of settlements defined. We have the village, the town, and the city. And in previous editions of the game, this was broken down anymore. Even more, you had small cities and large cities and metropolises and small towns and all this stuff. This is much more simplified, but I think it's really what you need, right? I mean, in this kind of setting, you've got the village, you've got the town, and you've got the city. And sure, you have smaller villages and bigger villages, and the same with towns and cities. But there's definite differences in feel and flavor between a village, a town, and a city. So, you know, it's pretty easy, I think, if you're thinking about a settlement, to ask yourself, is this a village, a town, or a city? Once you decide on that, then you can start drilling down more. So it says, most settlements in the D&D world are villages clustered around a larger town or city. Farming villages supply the town or city population with food in exchange for goods the farmers can't produce themselves. Towns and cities are the seats of the nobles who govern the surrounding area and who carry the responsibility for defending the villages from attack. Occasionally, a local lord or lady lives in a keep or fortress with no nearby town or city. Again, this is assuming medieval feudalism or something similar, as far as the society and how things are structured. So we start out with the village, which is the smallest settlement. So for population, this is saying a village could be anywhere up to 1,000 people. And again, these are guidelines. You know, it's not like if there's 1,001 people, it magically becomes a town. These are just guidelines to give you an idea. The government of a village: a noble, usually not a resident, rules the village with an appointed regent, a reeve, in residence to adjudicate disputes and collect taxes. So again, this is using terms from medieval feudalism. And as a world builder, one thing that you can do to give a different flavor to your world is to just use different titles and terms. You know, so maybe the reeve is called a mayor in your village, or whatever you want to call it. So, you know, you can change these terms or even use different social structures if you want to make your world different. Defense: the reeve might have a small force of soldiers. Otherwise, the village relies on a citizen militia. Commerce: basic supplies are readily available, possibly from an inn or a trading post. Other goods are available from traveling merchants. Organizations: a village might contain one or two temples or shrines, but few or no other organizations. Most settlements are agricultural villages, supporting themselves and nearby towns or cities with crops and meat. Villagers produce food in one way or another, if not by tending the crops, then supporting those who do by shoeing horses, weaving clothes, milling grain, and the like. The goods they produce feed their families and supply trade with nearby settlements. So there's kind of a basic setup for a village and how it could work economically. So most of the people that live in and near the village are going to be farmers, whether they're farming crops or they're herders, raising animals for meat and cows for milk and things like that. Or if they're not farmers, then there will be people in the village who help the farmers, you know, do what they do. So you could have the blacksmith that makes horseshoes and shoes horses and also makes the tools that the farmers use and things like that. You're going to have some limited trade in the village. You know, like they said, you might have an inn or a general store where player characters can buy basic goods and supplies. And there will be, from time to time, traveling merchants that come through town. And those merchants might have things for sale that one normally can't buy at the village. Opportunities are going to be fairly limited for player characters to sell high price items in the village, like gems and art objects and magical items and things like that, because, you know, most people at the village level are going to be working on barter, not so much paying for things with gold pieces or silver pieces. Exceptions being the merchants that come through, you know, owner of the general store or something like that, the innkeeper, you know, people like that will actually have some coin. But most of the people in the village will have little or no actual money and get what they need by barter. So the other thing is that, you know, what use is a gem to someone in a village, right? So even if someone has the means to purchase something from the PCs, they may not want to. So usually, you know, to sell their loot, the PCs are going to want to go to a larger settlement than a village. So that's, you know, something to consider when you're thinking about the PC's home base. Do I want it to be a village? Do I want it to be a town or a city? And there are pros and cons to all of them. You know, nice thing about a village is they're relatively small. I mean, you're talking like a maximum population of, say, 1,000 people could easily, you know, be in the hundreds instead. So as a GM, it's fairly easy to come up with a decent sampling of NPCs in the village that represent a lot of the people in the village. It's easier to map because it's smaller. You know, there's maybe only one inn in the village. You don't have to come up with five different inns and things like that. So in those ways, it can be easier. And there's also, you know, the limited supplies. So, you know, the PCs probably aren't going to be able to buy their suit of plate armor in a village. They might have a smith that's skilled enough to make one, but it's going to be a special order kind of thing. And it's going to take them a while to make it, right? Like, I have no idea how long it would take to make a suit of armor, but I'm guessing weeks, if not longer. You know, it's not like you can just buy one off the shelf in a village. So, you know, it's kind of, I think villages are great, especially for if you're starting a campaign at like first level. I think for low level characters, a village makes a great base of operations because there are kind of these limitations set. And also, it makes a lot more sense that the player characters can be the heroes of a village. The bigger the settlement, the greater the odds it seems like that there would be other adventurers, perhaps higher level adventurers around, certainly in a city, if not a town. But in a village, maybe the PCs are the only adventurers around. They're literally the only ones that can deal with this threat. And so you don't have to worry so much about, oh, well, why isn't some other group of heroes doing this? Why are they asking us to do it? There's also the limitations of, well, you know, you're not going to be able to buy super expensive things there. You're not going to necessarily be able to sell your art objects there, you know, and even, you know, using the gems that you find to trade, unless you're trading for something that's worth that gem, like you're not going to be in a situation where this villager is going to be able to give you change, right? If you pay with a gem. So it puts a little bit of a limit on what the PCs can do with the loot that they find and, you know, definitely probably aren't going to be able to sell off magic items that they find and things like that. And the reason I see that as a good thing at low level is it gives them a reason to move on at some point, right? Because you don't want them to necessarily stay in this village forever. You want them at some point to move on to bigger and better things. So, you know, it's kind of built into this of, well, you know, eventually you're going to accumulate all these gems and art objects that you can't really get the value for them here. You might have some magic items that you find that you don't want, that you want to try to sell. And you might want some items that you want to buy yourself, whether it's better armor or potions or whatever, that you can't buy at this village. So these are all good reasons to find a bigger settlement and to travel and go someplace new. A village's population is dispersed around a large area of land. Farmers live on their land, which spreads them widely around the village center. At the heart of the village, a handful of structures cluster together: a well, a marketplace, a small temple or two, a gathering place, and perhaps an inn for travelers. So just in these couple paragraphs here, I mean, really, you're given the skeleton of what you need to make a decent village. You can just kind of follow this as a laundry list and come up with these things that they mention and come up with those interesting NPCs, and you've got a good start on a village already. So next we'll talk about a town. This can have a population of up to 6,000. The government is a resident noble who rules and appoints a lord mayor to oversee administration. An elected town council represents the interests of the middle class. Defense. The noble commands a sizable army of professional soldiers as well as personal bodyguards. Commerce. Basic supplies are readily available, though exotic goods and services are harder to find. Inns and taverns support travelers. Organizations. The town contains several temples as well as various merchant guilds and other organizations. So you can see now that we've gone up a step from the village to the town, there are just more options of everything. There's more inns to choose from. There's more goods available for sale. There's more likelihood of being able to sell off stuff that the PCs have acquired. There's also more law and order. You know, there's a standing army or guard or whatever that the PCs will have to deal with if they run afoul of the law. So, you know, the stakes are kind of raised when you get to a town. Towns are major trade centers situated where important industries and reliable trade routes enabled the population to grow. So right there's some guidance on where to put a town. There's a reason a town is here. It's either, like they say, it's either on some kind of a trade route or it's some place where there's some kind of resource that's valuable. These settlements rely on commerce, the import of raw materials and food from the surrounding villages, and the export of crafted items to those villages, as well as to other towns and cities. A town's population is more diverse than that of most villages. So, you know, that's another good point is a village, you know, it might be all humans or it might be all halflings or whatever. A town, you're more likely to see more diversity of types of people that live there. Towns arise where roads intersect waterways, at the meeting of major land trade routes, around strategic defensive locations, or near significant mines or similar natural resources. So again, there's a list of possible reasons that this town could be here. And you should, you know, there should be a reason, one of those or some other good reason that there's a town here. You know, oftentimes towns grow from villages. So, you know, you saw this in like American history in the Old West. You saw this a lot where, you know, there might be like a gold rush somewhere or whatever, and this little boom town, you know, crops up. And, you know, starts out as a village, maybe grows to a town, and then maybe becomes a ghost town, or maybe eventually becomes a city. It all depends on what happens there. So next up from the town, the next step up is a city. This can have a population of up to 25,000, and depending on your setting, even more than 25,000. Government, a resident noble presides with several other nobles, sharing responsibility for surrounding areas and government functions. One such noble is the Lord Mayor, who oversees the city administration. An elected city council represents the middle class and might hold more actual power than the Lord Mayor. Other groups serve as important power centers as well. Defense. The city supports an army of professional soldiers, guards, and town watch. Each noble in residence maintains a small force of personal bodyguards. Commerce. Almost any goods or services are readily available. Many inns and taverns support travelers. Organizations. A multitude of temples, guilds, and other organizations, some of which hold significant power in city affairs, can be found within the city's walls. So again, we've ramped it up again. There's more options for places to stay, more options for trade, more things are available. There's also, you know, more armed guards and things like that walking around, more powerful NPCs and things like that. Cities are cradles of civilization. Their larger populations require considerable support from both surrounding villages and trade routes, so they are rare. Cities typically thrive in areas where large expanses of fertile, arable land surround a location accessible to trade, almost always on a navigable waterway. Cities almost always have walls, and the stages of a city's growth are easily identified by the expansion of the walls beyond the central core. These internal walls naturally divide the city into wards, neighborhoods defined by specific features, which have their own representatives on the city council and their own noble administrators. Cities that hold more than 25,000 people are extremely rare. Metropolises such as Waterdeep and the Forgotten Realms, Sharn and Eberron, and the Free City of Greyhawk stand as vital beacons of civilization in the D&D worlds. So, you know, that's an aspect of your world, is how big are the cities? For instance, in my world of Primordia, there aren't any cities like Waterdeep. There aren't any metropolises in Primordia. You know, my main city I've been focused on developing is the city of Alondria, and you know, it's not a large city at all. It's probably 25,000 or less. So, you know, I kind of, as far as like a Forgotten Realms analog, I picture it as, you know, maybe about the size of Silvery Moon. So it's not a large city by any means. And that's kind of par for the course in Primordia, because the only cities that are left are these really ancient cities, and none of them, at least that are known, are huge metropolises. Your world could be totally different, though. So, you know, that's something to think about and something that's going to give your world its own unique flavor. If you have a huge city like Waterdeep in your world, I mean, that's not a common thing in worlds like this. So that's going to mean something to your world. So cities have a lot more options of things that you can find within the city, and you can easily have a whole campaign take place in a single city. And, you know, if you're going to use a city for your beginning base of operations, then, you know, what you can do to make it a little more manageable, and this is kind of what I've been doing in Alondria, is focus in on one section of the city. So, for instance, in Alondria, I've been focusing on the Harbor District. So the adventures I've run in the city have pretty much taken place in the Harbor District, and I've started fleshing out in more detail what's there, what isn't, where things are located, things like that. But I haven't so much worried about the entire city. Again, it's been kind of like how I've approached Primordia overall, is, you know, I started with an overview of the city. I have an idea of, you know, what temples are in the city, what organizations are in the city, you know, general things like that. But then when it came time to thinking more specifically, I zeroed in on a particular ward, the Harbor District, and said, okay, we're going to flesh out the Harbor District and really focus on that. And then from there, we'll branch out into other parts of the city. So now that you've thought about, you know, in general terms, how big your city is, you know, maybe you've thought about some of these details, like, you know, what are some of the things that it trades in? Why is this city or this town or this village where it is? Then you can start thinking about the atmosphere. What do the adventurers first notice as they approach or enter a settlement? The towering wall bristling with soldiers, the beggars with hands outstretched, pleading for aid outside the gate, the noisy hubbub of merchants and buyers thronging the market square, the overpowering stench of manure. So this talks about, you know, coming up with some sensory details for your settlement. What are some of the sights and the sounds and the smells that greet the player characters when they enter it? And these are ways that you can make the place come alive and make it kind of a stronger image in the players' minds, and so they can actually kind of see this place and have a feeling that they know it. And it also is a way to make this a unique place, so when they visit different settlements, they can keep track what's what. You can also use these sensory details to give some clues about the settlement and what they might find there. So if they hear the ringing sound of, you know, a hammer pounding an anvil, then they know there's a smith in town. Things like that. It also suggests settling on a single defining factor that sums up a settlement's personality and then extrapolate from that. So maybe a city is built around canals like real world Venice. That key element suggests a wealth of sensory details, the sight of colorful boats floating on muddy waters, the sound of lapping waves and perhaps singing gondoliers, the smells of fish and waste polluting the water, the feel of humidity, etc., etc., etc. Or maybe the city is shrouded in fog much of the time, and you describe the tendrils of cold mist reaching through every crack and cranny, the muffled sounds of hooves on cobblestones, the cold air and the smell of rain, and a sense of mystery and lurking danger. So that's a great kind of trick that you can use to help you flesh out your city, and that will become very useful when it comes time to do things improvisationally as well. If you have one or two kind of unique things that define the city, then you can return to that when you're doing descriptions as the players go from place to place within the city, and use that as a launching off point for coming up with descriptions on the fly. The climate and terrain of a settlement's environment, its origin and inhabitants, its government and political position, and its commercial importance all have a bearing on its overall atmosphere. A city nestled against the edge of a jungle has a very different feel than one on the edge of a desert. Elf and dwarf cities present a distinct aesthetic, clearly identifiable in contrast to human-built ones. So yeah, so you know, there's great ideas in here of kind of a way to get kind of a thematic idea behind your city and or your village or town and go from there. All right, so next we talk about government. You might want to think about what kind of government does this settlement have. In the feudal society common in most D&D worlds, power and authority are concentrated in towns and cities. Nobles hold authority over the settlements where they live and the surrounding lands. They collect taxes from the populace, which they use for public building projects, to pay the soldiery, and to support a comfortable lifestyle for themselves. In exchange, they promise to protect their citizens from threats such as orc marauders, hobgoblin armies, and roving human bandits. Nobles appoint officers as their agents in villages to supervise the collection of taxes and serve as judges in disputes and criminal trials. These reeves, sheriffs, or bailiffs are commoners native to the villages they govern, chosen for their positions because they already hold the respect of their fellow citizens. Within towns and cities, lords share authority and administrative responsibility with lesser nobles, usually their own relatives, and also with representatives of the middle class, such as traders and artisans. A lord mayor of noble birth is appointed to head the town or city council and to perform the same administrative functions that reeves carry out in villages. The council consists of representatives selected by the middle class. Only foolish nobles ignore the wishes of their councils, since the economic power of the middle class is often more important to the prosperity of a town or city than the hereditary authority of the nobility. The larger a settlement, the more likely that other individuals or organizations hold significant power there as well. Even in a village, a popular individual, a wise elder or a well-liked farmer can wield more influence than the appointed reeve, and a wise reeve avoids making an enemy of such a person. In towns and cities, the same power might lie in the hands of a prominent temple, a guild independent of the council, or an individual with magical power. So those are all things to think about, and you know, I think you probably saw as we went through that there's a pretty good framework given for you there, whether you're talking about a town or a city or a village, where you can kind of set up kind of how the government works there. It's simple enough that it's easy to understand and deal with. You're not going to have to make a million NPCs to make it work. And there's definitely a lot to play with there. Things that can be exploited and ways that you can bring in some politics and some intrigue if you want. So next we have a discussion of different forms of government, and I'm not going to go through all these. There's quite a few. A lot of these are make-believe forms of government. A lot of these there haven't been governments like this on Earth. They're more fantasy things, and they're all kind of variations on a theme, and a lot of it really just comes down to who's in power in this particular government. They're all kind of assuming this kind of feudalist framework, but they have different people or groups of people that are sitting at the top and different reasons why those people are on top. So one thing that's interesting here, and we'll see this a lot in the DMG, is we're given a table, forms of government, and all of these different forms of government that they talk about here are arranged in this table, and are given values of 1 to 100. So if you wanted to, you could roll a D100 and randomly determine a form of government, if that's the way you want to roll. Now, I think usually what we're going to do is we're going to look through these and pick the one that we like or the one that fits our concept the best. But maybe you're just coming up with a village on the spot that your players are stopping at and you don't really plan to do much with it or you don't care. And so you might want to just do this randomly and just see what you get and see where it takes you. Another way you can approach this is roll on the table and see what you can generate for that as you're developing a settlement, see where it takes you. And you might, you know, come up with something you wouldn't have thought of using. And as you try to come up with ideas for that, you find something you really like. So that's another way you can approach it too. All right. So these are all on pages 18 and 19 in the DMG. I'm not going to go through everything that's given. I'm just going to go through these really quickly. And I encourage you to go read through this and investigate any that sound interesting to you. So we start with an autocracy where one hereditary ruler wields absolute power. This autocrat is either supported by a well-developed bureaucracy or military and stands as the only authority in an otherwise anarchic society. And a lot of these, they will give examples of places like this from the various D&D settings. Next, we have a bureaucracy where various departments compose the government, each responsible for an aspect of rule. We have a confederacy where each individual city or town within the confederacy governs itself, but all contribute to a league or federation that promotes the common good of all member states. We have a democracy where citizens or their elected representatives determine the laws for the settlement. We've got a dictatorship where one supreme ruler holds absolute authority, but his or her rule isn't necessarily dynastic. Feudalism, typical government of Europe in the Middle Ages, a feudalistic society consists of layers of lords and vassals. So if you don't want to spend a bunch of time on the government, you know, I'd recommend just going with feudalism because that's what's assumed. You know, all this stuff we've been talking about for the government of the settlements is assuming a feudalist model and the rest of the stuff in the DMG as well. So, you know, that's the easiest thing to do just because that's what's commonly found in the game. So if you're not super keen on coming up with government stuff, I'd just do feudalism and call it a day. Gerontocracy, elders preside over this society. There you go. The oldest people are in charge. Hierarchy, a feudal or bureaucratic government where every member except one is subordinate to another member. Kleptocracy. This government is composed of groups of individuals primarily seeking wealth for themselves, often at the expense of their subjects. So this could be like a thieves guild or something like that. Magocracy, however you want to say that. Magocracy, maybe. The governing body is composed of spellcasters who rule directly as oligarchs or feudal lords, or participate in a democracy or bureaucracy. So you can see, you know, some of these you can combine elements of one or the other. So the magocracy or however you say that is just basically there's mages at the top. So it could be a democracy otherwise or a bureaucracy or whatever. It just, the magocracy part just means it's a mage that's in power, presumably because he's a mage. Matriarchy or patriarchy. The society is governed by the oldest or most important members of one gender. Meritocracy. The most intelligent and educated people oversee the society, often with a bureaucracy to handle the day-to-day work of government. Militocracy. I think a lot of these are made-up words. But military leaders run the nation under martial law, using the army and other armed forces. Monarchy. A single hereditary sovereign wears the crown. Unlike the autocrat, the monarch's powers are limited by law, and the ruler serves as the head of a democracy, feudal state, or militocracy. Oligarchy. A small number of absolute rulers share power, possibly dividing the land into districts or provinces under their control, or jointly ruling together. Plutocracy. Society is governed by the wealthy. Republic. Government is entrusted to representatives of an established electorate who rule on behalf of the electors. Satrapy. Conquerors and representatives of another government wield power, ruling the settlement or region as part of a larger empire. And finally, theocracy. Rulership falls to a direct representative or a collection of agents of a deity. So there you go. You know, you can mix and match those and use them as inspiration to come up with your own fantasy government for your settlement. And then after this, we have a sample hierarchy of noble titles. So I was talking about how, you know, we're assuming in a lot of this stuff, a feudalist model, and how, you know, different ranks have titles associated with them, and how one way that you can kind of give a different flavor to your world or your settlement is to change those titles. So, you know, they have these ranked from first to 10th, from highest rank to lowest. And so we'll just go through this. At the top, we've got emperor or empress, then king or queen, then duke or duchess, then prince or princess, marquess, marquise, earl or count / countess, viscount, viscountess, baron, baroness, baronet, and then knight. Another thing you can think about when fleshing out a settlement is its commerce. Even small villages can provide characters access to the gear they need to pursue their adventures. Provisions, tents, backpacks, and simple weapons are commonly available. Traveling merchants carry armor, martial weapons, and more specialized gear. Most villages have inns that cater to travelers, where adventurers can find a hot meal and a bed, even if the quality leaves much to be desired. Villages rely heavily on trade with other settlements, including larger towns and cities. Merchants pass through regularly, selling necessities and luxuries to the villagers, and any successful merchant has far-reaching contacts across the region. Traveling merchants pass on gossip and adventure hooks to the characters as they conduct their businesses. So yeah, it's a great NPC to think about for your settlement is a traveling merchant or more than one traveling merchant. They can be a great way to provide information, either true or false, about what's going on in the wider world, as well as access to goods that normally wouldn't be available, as well as the ability to sell things they normally wouldn't be able to sell in this location, and even quest hooks. Since merchants make their living traversing roads that might be menaced by bandits or wandering monsters, they hire guards to keep their goods safe. They also carry news from town to town, including reports of situations that cry out for the attention of adventurers. So if you're trying to get your PCs to go from the starting village to somewhere else in the world, a traveling merchant with news from the next town over can be a great way to hopefully motivate them to go check that thing out. These merchants can't provide the services normally found in the city. For instance, when the characters are in need of a library or a dedicated sage, a trainer who can handle the griffin eggs they found, or an architect to design their castle, they're better off going to a large city than looking in a village. And again, not only does this make sense and add verisimilitude to your world, but it also gives the players reason to go from one place to another. All right, next we have a discussion of currency. The straightforward terms gold piece, silver piece, copper piece, electrum piece, and platinum piece are used throughout the game rules for clarity. You can imbue these denominations with more interesting descriptions in your game world. People give coins specific names, whether as plain as dime or lively as golden double eagle. Or gold double eagle, whatever. A country typically mints its own currency, which might correspond to the basic rules terms. In most worlds, few currencies achieve widespread distribution, but nearly all coins are accepted worldwide, except by those looking to pick a fight with a foreigner. And I tell you what, if you're interested in coins and you'd like to see an example of a setting where some thought is given to this fact that, you know, every country is minting their own coins, I highly recommend the Wheel of Time. Every country in that setting has their own coins. Robert Jordan, the author, does a great job of showing kind of how that works and how, you know, a gold piece in different countries have different weights and therefore have different values. And they're, you know, the coins you use can sometimes give away where you've been or where you come from or what your associations are. And there are some places where certain coins aren't accepted or where they're valued more highly or less highly than they normally would be. So that's something, you know, if you really want to get granular and you really want to start fleshing out the flavor of your world, you can start thinking of what kind of coins do the different places have and how are those coins viewed in other places. So following this, we have an example, or actually a series of examples from the Forgotten Realms of some of the different coins that are used in different places in the realms and how they're called different things. So a gold piece is called different things in different places, and how there are even coins that they talk about in here that don't fit the normal gold piece, silver piece, etc. that we have. So they talk about in Waterdeep, there's a local coin called the Toll, which is a square brass trading coin pierced with a central hole to permit it to be easily strung on a ring or string. And it's worth 2 gold pieces in the city and is worth nothing outside of Waterdeep. So that's an example of a more specialized coin. They also have the Harbor Moon, which is a flat crescent of platinum with a central hole and an electrum inlay, named for its traditional use in the docks for buying large amounts of cargo at once. So this coin is worth 50 gold in Waterdeep, but is only worth 30 gold in other places. To talk about the city of Silvery Moon, one of my favorite places in the Forgotten Realms, has a crescent-shaped shining blue coin called an Electrum Moon, which is worth 1 gold piece in Silvery Moon and 1 Electrum piece everywhere else. They have a larger coin called an Eclipsed Moon, which looks like an Electrum Moon combined with a darker silver wedge to form a round coin worth 5 Electrum within the city and 2 Electrum outside of it. And we also have on page 20 of the DMG some images of examples of a copper, gold, platinum, silver, and electrum coin. And these are interesting because, you know, I always assume that coins are round unless told otherwise. And actually, none of these coins are round. So, you know, that's something else you can play with is the shape of the coin, what's stamped on either side of the coin. So you can really, you know, go over the moon with creativity when it comes to coming up with coinage for your world. I would just caution you to, you know, think about your players and think about keeping things, you know, understandable and whatnot. Don't make your coin so complicated and whatnot that the players are never sure what anything is. So that would be my one caution. I think an easy way to do it and to avoid, you know, confusion is you can have the standard, you know, gold, silver, platinum, and all that, and just give those coins special names in certain places. So maybe, you know, in this city, the gold piece is called a gold dragon, you know, so you can say, hey, that'll be 5 gold dragons. And it's pretty easy for the players to know, oh, that's 5 gold pieces, that kind of thing, as opposed to messing with what the actual coins are worth. So just, you know, as a quick aside here, you know, with the exception of the Electrum, the coins are all decimal based. Each coin is in increments of 10. So a silver piece is worth 10 copper pieces. A gold piece is worth 10 silver pieces. And a platinum piece is worth 10 gold pieces, which makes it really easy to do math and things like that. Electrum are different in that an electrum is half a gold piece or 5 silver pieces. Then we have trade bars, and trade bars are something I really like and I like to use whenever I can. And this is an actual bar of precious metal, and it's a way that you can have something that would be worth multiple coins, but only have one object. And it makes sense that banks would use these, and merchants and other people that are trading currency in large amounts instead of huge bags of coins. So it does make it, you know, problematic coming up with times when you can use these, because they're not going to make sense to find all the time. But I really love using trade bars whenever I can. Large numbers of coins can be difficult to transport and account for. And I believe, if I remember off the top of my head, the general rule is 50 coins equals 1 pound. Many merchants prefer to use trade bars, ingots of precious metals and alloys, usually silver, likely to be accepted by virtually anyone. Trade bars are stamped or graven with the symbol of the trading company or government that originally crafted them. These bars are valued by weight as follows. And again, this is following the 50 coins equals £1. So you can do the math and these line right up. So a 2-pound silver bar is worth 10 gold. It's about 5 inches long, 2 inches wide, and a half inch thick. A 5-pound silver bar is worth 25 gold and is about 6 inches long, 2 inches wide, and 1 inch thick. A 5-pound gold bar is worth 250 gold and is about the size of a 2-pound silver bar. So for my city of Alandria, I had some fun with this and I decided trade bars were something that they used a lot. And I expanded this a bit. So we have in the DMG here, we've got the 2-pound silver bar worth 10 gold, the 5-pound silver bar worth 25 gold, and the 5-pound gold bar worth 250 gold. So I added to that in Alandria, they also make 2-pound platinum bars that are worth 1,000 gold and 5-pound platinum bars that are worth 2,500 gold. So, you know, I encourage you to have fun with the coinage. It's a great way that you can add some flavor to your world, and it can even serve story purposes, you know, because if you establish that different cities mint different coins and different coins were minted in different time periods, when the, you know, player characters search the body of a bandit they've killed, the coins that he carries can tell them something about who he is, where he's from, where he's been, things like that. Similarly, if they find a treasure somewhere, the coins that they find within that treasure could give them clues to how old that treasure is. So, you know, you can have a lot of fun with it. It can be a great way to really add a lot of flavor to your world. I would just, again, caution you not to go too overboard with it and try to avoid making it too obtuse or confusing for your players. Next, we have a discussion on languages and dialects. When fleshing out your world, you can create new languages and dialects to reflect its unique geography and history. You can replace the default languages presented in the PHB with new ones or split languages up into several different dialects. In some worlds, regional differences might be much more important than racial ones. Perhaps all the dwarves, elves, and humans who live in one kingdom speak a common language, which is completely different from that spoken in the neighboring kingdom. This might make communication and diplomacy between two kingdoms significantly more difficult. And I would say that's actually a more realistic way to do it. The language you speak would have a lot more to do with where you live than anything else. Widely used languages might have ancient versions, or there might be completely different ancient tongues that adventurers find written in tombs and ruins. Such languages can add an element of mystery to inscriptions and tomes that characters encounter. And that's a great thing to do is, you know, if your player characters find some ancient ruin, they can't read the inscriptions because it's in some language from long ago that maybe they don't speak. And that can also be cool because there are various spells in the game that allow you to understand languages you can't speak, and it makes those spells useful. You might invent additional secret languages. Besides Druidic and Thieves' Cant that allow members of certain organizations or political affiliations to communicate. You can even decide that each alignment has its own language. If you want to go that right route, more power to you, but no, it's not for me. In a region where one race has subjugated another, the language of the conquerors can become a mark of social status. Similarly, reading and writing might be restricted by law to the upper classes of a society. So there you go. You know, there's something else you can think about when fleshing out your world is, I mean, you can use the languages in the player's handbook and have common and elven and dwarven and all that good stuff. And those languages are basically center around race. You know, each race for the most part has its own language. You know, the demons have a language, the devils have a language, the earth elementals have a language, et cetera, et cetera. Or you could, like they were saying, you could replace those with regional languages or augment them with regional languages. I think at the very least, it would make sense to do that with common. I think to have this idea that there's this common tongue that's spoken over the whole world is not super realistic. So you might have different common tongues in different areas. So maybe, for instance, in my world of Primordia, in the area around Alandria, there's what we call common, which most people of that area can speak. It's a trade language, no matter what race they are or what city they're from. But if you go to another continent, they have a different language that's their trade language, which nobody around Alondra would probably know. So, I mean, obviously, if I was going to do that, I'd want to come up with a better name for the language in common, because every continent or every country would have their own common. And that would get super confusing. So I'd want to come up with maybe Alondrian instead of common or something like that. So there you go. I think we'll wrap up our discussion there. And we've considered quite a few things that you can think about and play with in creating a settlement and creating diversity from one settlement to another. Well, that is going to wrap it up for episode 158. If you would like to get a hold of me, please visit my website, starwalkerstudios.com. There you can email me. You can find my Twitter, Google+, Facebook, Pinterest, YouTube, and you can find the Game Master's Journey voicemail number where you can call and leave me a message. If your question or feedback is entertaining or enlightening or both, you might even hear your message on the show. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future topics, I would love to hear from you. Also, at StarWalkerStudios.com, you can find a link to the Game Master's Journey community where you can share ideas with other listener GMs. And finally, you can learn about how you can support the show by becoming a patron, by making a one-time donation, by using my Amazon referral link when you shop on Amazon, or by purchasing my D&D adventure, the Twixters. Oh my God. The Trickster's Labyrinth. You can find all this and more at StarWalkerStudios.com. And even if you want, you can question the Twixter. Ask the Twixter questions. I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I hope you have a chance to run your favorite RPG. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on. The Twixter's Labyrinth. Question the Twixter.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at StarWalkerStudios.com/Game Master's Journey.